This is Jeff Blankford with a November 2nd edition of Takes on the World, a program on international affairs that usually comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. This is, of course, the first Wednesday of November, and as Joy LeClaire, who normally hosts Fourth Right Radio on the first and third Wednesdays, told you last week, we exchange dates. As it happens, last week I was participating in a panel at UC Berkeley sponsored by the Italian Cultural Institute to discuss Seize the Time, a film on the Black Panthers made by a close friend of mine, the late Italian filmmaker Antonello Branca. Shot in 1968 and 69 and completed in 1971, its contents are sadly all too relevant today, as is the story of the Black Panthers, founded in Oakland in 1966, whose surviving members are currently celebrating the party's 50th anniversary and inspiring many members of the movement for black lives of the present generation. Back in the late 60s, the Panthers also inspired and worked with groups like the Brown Berets from the Chicano community, the Iwakun and the Red Guard from the Asian community, the Young Lords from New York's Puerto Rican neighborhoods, and the American Indian movement, which grew out of the occupation of Alcatraz in 1969. One can trace a direct line from the taking over of Alcatraz 47 years ago to the occupation and protest by the Standing Rock Sioux and their Indian and non-Indian allies against the building of that oil pipeline in North Dakota, which has been ongoing for months and most recently has been facing an escalation in state-ordered violence. When President Obama and his chosen successor Hillary Clinton will weigh in on this is anybody's guess, although I understand Obama did make a statement this morning. But the only pressure thus far for Clinton to do or say something about it is an online petition asking her to take action to stop the building of the pipeline after she is in office. That's a sad commentary on both Clinton and those of her supporters who claim to be concerned about Standing Rock. To quote the late Kurt Vonnegut, so it goes. Well, last week, Joy LeClaire also conveyed our sincerest thanks to those of you who pledged to KZYX during our extremely successful October 19th fundraising program. We would not be here without your continued support. So thank you from the bottom of our hearts. By this time next week, when I'm back with you for my regular second Wednesday program, we will probably know who will be our next president. I say probably because nothing in this made-in-hell presidential campaign resembles any that we have seen before and with luck we'll never see again. And so next Wednesday, rather than bringing you some knowledgeable guests to comment on the results, I will be opening the phones to get your takes on what happened and where the nation's headed. Of one thing we can be sure, this nation will still be at war, it will still have troops in most of the countries of the world, and will still be divided, and dangerously so, in a way that our country has not been since the Civil War. On the war front, it already promises to be anything but the status quo. Even with election days away, the Pentagon is making preparations to expand the war in Syria, as last Thursday's New York Times reported. Citing senior Defense Department and military officials, the papers Helene Cooper and Eric Schmidt wrote that, quote, the fight to retake Raqqa, the Syrian city that serves as the capital of the Islamic State, must begin soon, within weeks, to disrupt planning believed to be underway there to stage terrorist attacks on the West, end quote. Lieutenant General Stephen Townsend, the top American military commander in Iraq, not surprisingly, declined to name a specific threat against Western targets emanating from Raqqa, according to the Times, but described a, quote, sense of urgency, unquote. He said it was imperative that operations to isolate the city begin soon to prevent attacks on the West that could be launched or planned from the militants' capital. This is just an excuse, of course, like Iraq's so-called weapons of mass destruction, to justify the warmakers in Washington escalating our involvement in the Syrian morass, which constitute no direct threat to the United States, since there is no evidence that any terrorist attack in this country originated from Syria. The assault on Raqqa will apparently be taking place even as the U.S., providing support from the air, pushes a mixture of Iraqi forces to eject the Islamic State or ISIL from Mosul, Iraq's second-largest city, which it has occupied for the past 2 years. To contrast how the media is covering the U.S.-led offensive in Mosul, and contrasted with how it is reporting on the Russian-backed efforts of the Syrian government to retake Aleppo, Syria's second-largest city, from al-Qaeda-linked fighters, I'll be speaking again with Robert Perry, the award-winning journalist at Consortium News, at 20 minutes past the hour. We'll also be talking about a New York Times reporter on the ground and missions Saturday at the al-Nusra Front, al-Qaeda's Syrian franchise, as Washington's indisputable ally in the war against Syrian President Bashar Assad, so stay tuned for that. The planned assault on Raqqa, according to the details provided by the Times, seems to be a prescription for chaos. First of all, it is ignoring the objections of Turkey, a critical U.S. ally and NATO member, to include Kurdish forces in the operation, since it fears that aspirations for autonomy may spread among its own Kurdish population, with whom it has been in a state of conflict for decades. General Townsend stressed that Kurdish militia fighters would be part of the ground force used to isolate Raqqa. Sounding as if he had taken English lessons from Donald Rumsfeld, he told reporters of the Pentagon during a video news briefing from Baghdad that, quote, "We're going to go with who can go, who's willing to go soon. And then once we get the initial isolation in position, we'll look at how we prosecute the operation further," end quote. Well, hope you understood that. Turkey considers the Syrian Kurdish fighters known as the YPG to be an extension of the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PPK, the Kurdish rebel group that has sought autonomy from Turkey since the 1980s. Ankara, which was largely responsible for allowing Islamic State fighters into Syria in the first place, has demanded that the YPG not take part in the fight to retake Raqqa. U.S. military officials say the YPG personnel are the best fighters they have. "Well, the facts are these," said General Townsend. "The only force that's capable on any near-term timeline is the Syrian Democratic Forces, of which the YPG are a significant portion," end quote. While he intends for the Kurds to make up the bulk of the operations, Townsend said many of the more than 300 American Special Operation Forces now in Syria would help recruit, train, and equip local forces in and around Raqqa who are predominantly Syrian Arabs. They've done that before. It hasn't worked very well. Well, the impending operation is further complicated, the Times reporters note, because neither the Turks nor the Syrian Kurds view the recapture of Raqqa as a priority. They quote Christopher Kozak, a Syria researcher at the Institute for the Study of War, as saying that what the fighting in Syria so far has consistently demonstrated that, quote, "the Syrian Kurdish YPG do not truly desire to shed blood to capture a majority Sunni Arab city far from their vision of their autonomous borders, while Turkey cares about the operation only insofar as the Syrian Kurdish YPG is not allowed to participate in it," end quote. In other words, General Townsend views the Kurds as mercenaries. Whether they will suddenly become willing to die to fulfill the Pentagon's agenda, we'll have to wait and see. I very much doubt it. Whether Turkish President Recep Erdogan will allow the Kurds to do so, should they so choose, is also open to question, since he had previously used U.S. fighter jets provided by the Obama administration to attack the Islamic State instead to attack the Kurds. The remarks of U.S. War Secretary Ashton Carter on the situation reveal him to be as clueless as anyone who has held that position. He said in Brussels last Wednesday that the offensive to oust the Islamic State from Raqqa would begin within weeks. Quote, "This is, as always, a matter when you're positioning forces and so forth. We have a plan to do that and a schedule to do that," end quote, Mr. Carter told reporters. "We're going to execute that plan," end quote. Meanwhile, on Friday, the Alliance of Foreign Jihadists and Syrian Rebels in Aleppo launched what Times reporters based in Beirut describe as a major offensive against government positions in the western part of the city. This they depicted as a strong sign that rebel forces vetted by the United States were continuing their tactical alliances with groups linked to al-Qaeda, rather than distancing themselves as Russia has demanded and Washington has urged. Russia has reserved the right to attack anyone working with al-Qaeda-linked groups, saying there is little distinction between them. The rebels argue that they cannot afford to shun any potential allies while they are under fire, including well-armed and motivated jihadists, without more robust aid from their international backers, the Saudis, Qatar, United States, and so on. Eastern Aleppo, where the opposition is based, has a population estimated at 250,000, while as many as 1.5 million live in the government-controlled western part of the city. The latter have been under constant shelling from the al-Qaeda-linked forces, but as victims have yet to merit the space in the U.S. media afforded to those in the east. Leading the offensive has been the Levant Conquest Front, formerly known as the Nusra Front, which was part of al-Qaeda and another hardline Islamist faction, Ahrar al-Sham. The unfortunate truth, however, is that the U.S.-backed groups remain somewhat dependent upon the al-Qaeda-linked groups for organization and firepower in these operations, says Jean-Viev Casagrande, a Syria research analyst at the Institute for the Study of War in Washington. Ironically, the new offensive brought to an end a week-long ceasefire unilaterally declared by the Russians, who dropped leaflets calling for civilians and rebels to leave the eastern districts of Aleppo to humanitarian corridors, warning that anyone who stayed could be killed. There'll be more on this story, of course, when I speak with Bob Perry in just a few minutes. On the past broadcasts, I have mentioned that one of the most censored stories in the U.S. media has been the fact that the Lebanese political party, an anti-Israel resistance group, Hezbollah, has been in a formal alliance for more than a decade with the largest of the country's Maronite Christian parties, the Free Patriotic Movement, and its leader, a former general as well as a former president of Lebanon, Michel Aoun. The reason for the silence is obvious. The mainstream media takes its cues from the Israel lobby. Consequently, it routinely portrays Hezbollah as if it was a Shia version of al-Qaeda or even the Islamic State, which it has been fighting in Syria, neglecting to mention that it emerged as a resistance movement to Israel's occupation of Lebanon following its 1982 invasion of that country. On Monday, spreading that Israeli propaganda became a challenge. When, as Israel's Haaretz reported, quote, Lebanon's parliament elected Hezbollah-backed Michel Aoun president after 2.5 years of having the position unfilled. The New York Times continued to knuckle under, not even mentioning Aoun in his Tuesday headlines and not a hint about his ties to Hezbollah. Aoun's election is being seen by Israel and its supporters as a major victory for what it calls the Iran-Syria-Hezbollah axis and a critical setback for Saudi Arabia, which has long backed Lebanon's Sunni-led March 14th alliance. The account in Haaretz, which is a frequent critic of Israeli government policies, was more tactful, noting that, quote, many in Lebanon and the Arab world see the election as an opening for optimism in the region and possibly a sign of Saudi Arabia's weakening as a sponsor of many parties and political organizations in the Arab world, and in particular Hariri's anti-Syrian March 14th alliance, end quote. Hariri refers to Saeed Hariri, son of former Lebanese prime minister and Saudi ally, multi-billionaire builder Rafik Hariri, who was assassinated by a car bomb in Beirut in 2005 that was blamed on Syria. As part of the agreement to support Aoun's candidacy, Hariri will become prime minister, charged with forming a government under Lebanon's political system, in which the president must be a Maronite Christian, the prime minister a Sunni, and the speaker of parliament a Shia. Aoun, speaking after his election, alluded to the conflict with Israel, saying, quote, we will be always be ready to help and support the resistance forces in order to liberate every last meter of Lebanese territory that has not yet been returned and the attempts to take over natural resources, end quote. Aoun was referring in that last part to Israel's long-held desire to control the waters of Lebanon's Litani River, which was one of the reasons it had launched its war in 1982, ostensibly to eliminate the PLO. When I was last in Beirut in the fall of 2007, I spent 45 minutes in conversation with Michel Aoun, who told me that the basis for his support for Hezbollah was that without the resistance group, the Israelis would simply take over Lebanon as it had following the 1982 invasion. At that time, it became clear that Israel had no intention of leaving southern Lebanon. The following year, when I was there, its troops began treating the country's Shia population as sadistically as they treated the Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza. With the backing of Iran and support of the majority of the Lebanese people, Hezbollah emerged and began an armed struggle to rid the country of its Israeli occupiers. 17 years later, in 2000, under pressure from mothers who were seeing too many of their sons killed, the Israelis unilaterally withdrew from all but a small section of land, which remains a flashpoint to this day. That was what Aoun was referring to when he spoke of liberating every last meter of Lebanese territory that has not yet been returned, end quote. The new president also pledged to confront the issue of refugees arriving from Syria in order to return them to their homeland, With regard to the Palestinian refugees, we shall always aspire to implement the right of return for those refugees, end quote. As Haaretz's Lebanese correspondent Jack Houri described it, an Aoun victory marks a remarkable turn of fortune for the former general who fought two wars in the late 1980s at the end of Lebanon's 1975-90 civil war, one against Syria and the other against rival Christian forces. His subsequent alliance with Hezbollah, backed by its Syrian and Iranian patrons, helped to cement divisions in the once dominant Maronite Christian community, wrote Khoury. But it also angered the United States, which views Hezbollah, a heavily armed group and Syria's strongest Lebanese ally, as a terrorist organization. His election will also be viewed as a victory for Hezbollah, Tehran, and Damascus over Hariri's Sunni allies in Riyadh, at a time when Saudi Arabia has appeared to retreat from Lebanon as it prioritizes fighting Iran in the Gulf. It will also raise questions over Western policy toward Lebanon, whose army depends on U.S. military aid, concluded Haaretz's Jack Khoury. Indeed, the U.S. Army Security Assistance Command delivered more than $50 million worth of weapons and military equipment to Lebanon to support the Middle East nation's counterterrorism battle on the Syrian border, according to the Army's webpage. A Navy charter carrying 50 Humvees, 40 howitzers, 15,000 mortars, 300,000 50-caliber rounds, grenade launchers, and Hellfire air-to-surface missiles left North Carolina's military ocean terminal, Sunny Point, the largest military terminal in the world, docking at the port of Beirut on August 8th. Following the elections, expect the new situation in Lebanon to get Congress's attention. And speaking of elections, a newly released audio has revealed that then-Senator Hillary Clinton lamented the United States' failure to rig the 2006 Palestinian elections, which saw Hamas defeat the Western-backed Fatah. The recording is from a meeting that September between Clinton, representing New York, and the Brooklyn-based right-wing Jewish Press newspaper. Of the Palestinian election the previous January, she says, quote, "I do not think we should have pushed for an election in the Palestinian territories. I think it was a big mistake. If we are going to push for an election," she said, "then we should have made sure we did something to determine who is going to win," end quote, as the Democratic National Committee did for her in the case of Bernie Sanders. Hamas won 74 of 132 seats, compared to Fatah's 45 seats, an election deemed free and fair by international observers. George W. Bush's Republican administration backed the elections and accepted the outcome, and there hasn't been another Palestinian election since. This is Jeff Blankfort. Thanks very much for listening.